Monday morning. Day is dawning. Yeah.
No, keep going. That's okay.
No, it's just the restless year. Look out, the world's behind you. Always somewhere to catch you if you fall. How'd you like that?
I like it a lot.
Okay. Hi, I'm Steve Kilby from the church. You're listening to Drinks with Tony on Pirate Cat Radio. Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
Yeah. You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have J.D. Samuels Cuba. She's the author of Your Last First Date, Secrets from a Hollywood Matchmaker. J.D., how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming. I mean, I got to tell you, as a fella that has tapped lightly in the dating scene in Los Angeles, I'm from San Francisco. So as a fella that's tapped lightly in the dating scene in Los Angeles, I need some reassurance. I need some hope. How?
Well, first you sign up with me.
That's okay.
How
okay.
You get started. No, it's tough out there. It's the whole reason that I started a matchmaking business in the first place. So while yes, of course, it's I am a true romantic at heart. I wouldn't go into this line of work if I didn't believe, you know, there was someone out there for everyone. But I do believe there need to be people like me that help you find it to supplement what you're already doing, just because it is so tough. And so I'm not egotistical enough to think I'm going to find everyone their husband or wife, but I'm passionate enough to believe that I could help you on that journey while you're looking yourself.
Do you think that's because of the time we live in where everything is so online and digital based that there used to be a time, I mean, when I was younger, I had less weight on me and I was much sexier when I was younger. So there's that.
Sexier than this? That's a tough bar to beat.
yeah, I know. But no, it's just like when you're exuding more of that primal instinct of what we are as humans, where it's just like it's mating season when you're in your, like, you know, 20s and 30s. And it's but you could tell me I'm wrong in any of this. If you
I've got 70, 80 year olds in mating season right now. So you never
okay.
Know.
Yeah. I love that. Yes.
Yeah.
Let's go back to that, but I don't even remember what I was saying. What was I saying?
We're talking about your level of sexiness and how it's declining.
Yeah, that went south quick. Maybe we should segue straight to the 70 and 80 year olds. No. I was talking about timing because we're in such an online culture where we used to interact more, not only in dating, but just in life in general. There was so many more interactions to life in general, where now everyone's looking down on their phone, and it makes me laugh when say places like on the New York subway or something, and you see every person looking down at their phone, where it would be, you know, in the 90s, it would be people with books.
Right.
And then if they had a book and I would walk up to them and I'm like, oh my God, how do you like that book? Because I really want to know, because I consume books like a maniac. So do you think where we are now time-wise and all this digital obsession that we have, which I indulge in as well, do you think that's part of the hard to find a romantic partner because of that?
Absolutely. I was on someone's podcast not that long ago. She met her partner on the train in Boston. You know, that doesn't happen anymore because, exactly like you said, it's all digital. Also, people are afraid of rejection, you know, have always been, but they used to have to put themselves out there face to face to get a date. Now it's like, okay, maybe you see an attractive person at the grocery store, but you're not going to go up to them because maybe they have a girlfriend or boyfriend already, right? But you could just open up your phone at the grocery store and satisfy that same urge by just swiping on some people. So it's a combination of everything's digital, and also now we have a shield for our fear of rejection.
Fascinating, because here's my thing. Like, I don't have too much fear of rejection. I like to approach people, and it's gotten worse since COVID. Like, for some odd reason, during COVID, people were freaked out about eye contact. I remember, like, the first, like, few months, I'm like, dude, we can look at each other. You don't have to look down because our eyeballs aren't going to intertwine. It was so strange. And I feel like there was a huge shift there and people being scared to be approached because you might give me COVID when we both have, like, masks on and gloves and we're walking around in our suits.
You mean COVID's not emitted through laser beams through your eyes? It doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was like, hi. Sometimes I just like to mess with people because I get frustrated with society and I need to stop that. But I've approached women at the grocery store and I'll talk to them. And I'm not talking to them. They happen to be attractive, but I'm just talking to them about life in general. And the times that I've gotten phone numbers, when I call them, I get ghosted. And I feel like it's such a shocking thing for a dude to walk up to a woman and do that, that I feel like, and this could be me projecting so much of my childhood trauma that has nothing to do with the lady that I give my phone number to, but I feel like they think I'm some type of player when I'm doing that, when I'm not. I'm the exact opposite of that. I am only looking for a relationship. I'm not looking for, you know, a one-night stand.
I would not curb that instinct. I think that it's just a matter of time before you approach the right woman at the grocery store. So don't let the wrong people ghosting you make you feel like you shouldn't be doing that at all. That being said, I do think that there is, for women, all kinds of safety concerns that are at the forefront of their minds that maybe weren't as ever present maybe a generation or two ago. And I think that a lot of times, like if someone is approached for their phone number, there's this feeling of, okay, there's this man in front of me. I don't know, you know, anyone else around me. I feel like I just need to be nice and placate this person. I'm not talking to you specifically. I'm just saying in general.
I do kind of got that look, though. I do have a look where I can kind of mug you on the way out. I mean, I understand that. And I try to, like, go, hey, you know what? I'm not going to mug you.
But there's also, like, the Christian Bale American Psychos of the world, you know, where, like, they look like they wouldn't.
Oh my God. So Bret Easton Ellis getting his film adapted has ruined life for men who want a romantic relationship with women at grocery stores.
But it's not even romance. Like, okay, so for example, my dad is amazing about telling everyone about my book. So he's also like you. He'll chat with a person in line behind him at Starbucks. So he's telling everyone about my book. I can't tell you how many times he reaches out to me and he's like, I just connected with this person and she's so excited to sign up for your matchmaking or your date coaching service. Or she told me she bought your book, like all these things. And then, you know, he'll give me the phone number. I'm going to reach out to that person. And then I just don't hear from them. And I'm like, Dad, you know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't. Please tell the whole world about my book. But his expectation is that 100% of those people that say, like, oh my God, that's so cool that she does this, I'm going to reach out to her, are then going to actually communicate with me, sign up for a coaching session. Once in a while, people do, and it's wonderful. I want to help the whole world find love. And so, you know, every new person I get, there's a greater chance that I can do that for the people I'm currently working with. But, you know, it's just funny because that's not romantic at all. That's just, oh, my dad, like, talk to someone, it came up that she's single. My dad is married, not looking, right? Double, triple the age in some cases of some of these people. So it's not like he's hitting on them, but they feel an obligation of like, oh, that sounds so great. Of course I'd love, you know, a book, or of course I'd love to talk to her. And they give out their phone number with no intention, you know? And so that's just an example. I don't know why I'm using myself, but probably easiest frame of reference. But this is all to say, don't feel bad. It's just a very psychologically, it's an instinct, right? That we have to, okay, there's this person in front of me. They want this thing from me. Let me get out of the situation. But the easiest thing is like, here's my number. And then later I could just not engage. But it's harder to say to somebody's face, oh, you know what? I'm actually, it doesn't sound like something I would read, or I don't feel like I need a matchmaker right now, or, you know, I'm probably not going to go on a date with you, so I'm just not going to give out my phone number. That's a hard thing for a lot of people to say, and it's easier, and we're primed to, especially in the age of swiping culture where people ghost each other all the time, right? It's just easier for people to say, okay, I'll do it, and then now I'm no longer in front of you. I don't feel compelled to actually follow through on that. And I can ghost just like everyone else is ghosting these days.
Fascinating. The thing about saying, well, there could be a no in the, it's like, I don't feel either, you could say, I don't feel comfortable giving out my number. I've said that to people because we live in Los Angeles, and I feel like Los Angeles is like a vampire of energy, where it's just like people want to talk to you because they want to figure out what they can get from you. I go to some of these industry events and people ask me, well, what do you do? And I just go, I'm a teacher. So they'll talk to me one-on-one if they care. When I tell them I'm a writer and they find out I've done screenwriting, all of a sudden I have this great one-way conversation with them telling me how their idea would make a great film.
Of
And
course.
then they want to hey, let me get you a drink. Let me do this. And I just want to slap them. But I control myself. Because societal expectations are we can't slap anymore. That's 1800s, we can't do it now. But and that's why that's why Los Angeles drives me nuts, because the vibration of like, what can you do for me? And I call it eager eyes. It's something that I come from a very working class suburb of San Francisco. It's just like I grew up being blunt. So blunt is cool, or a dude or a girl can say, "Hey, I got a boyfriend, I got a girlfriend," and it's just like, "Oh yeah, okay, cool." The other thing is, I'm just going all over the place. I'll
Sounds
stop.
great.
You feel free to comment and tell me where I'm wrong,
No, I agree with you. Like I not only have had the eager eyes, but I've also been on the receiving end of the eager eyes because yeah, I don't know how much you know about my background, but I started as a TV writer. I still write TV. The book's been like the thrill of my lifetime, but in terms of how I got started, like the whole eager eyes industry thing, everyone needing something from someone else is not a foreign concept. And I have to tell you, starting the matchmaking company 15 years ago and now being in a place where my primary source of income has shifted to date coaching, writing about dating, matchmaking, everything in the dating space, as opposed to my primary source of income coming from the entertainment industry, that switch has been such a, it's been like a weight has been lifted. And I talk to people to get to know them. I'm not talking to someone because I want to know what they could do for me in the industry, and vice versa when someone's talking to me. You know, it's I can introduce myself as a matchmaker and a dating coach, and I actually want them to get something from me. Like I'm so eager to set people up and to help them. So it's just a completely different shift of mindset both ways, and it's made life so much more interesting, so much more engaging. I can look someone in the eye and be present for a conversation. And again, not thinking like, what can we do for each other, you know, in terms of the film TV of it all. And it's so nice. And I wish I had that when I was younger, but at least I get to do it now.
Yeah, you don't seem that when you were younger. Let me tell you, you don't look anything near middle age, but you might be, because Los Angeles is a very fooling kind of town. Because not because of I didn't mean that in a way of Botox. I meant that in a way of everyone does keep themselves fit, because there is a bit of a better standard here, and I like that, because I would probably be fatter than I am if I didn't live in LA. So if you're around it enough, you're like, hey, I can't look. It's like, oh, well, there goes those pants. Well, I can't. I gotta fit back into the other pants. Here's
Well,
me
take the
back.
compliment. I'm gonna blame my new haircut and Zoom filters.
Well, your new haircut is fabulous, and you got great Zoom filters. I didn't even notice. That's fascinating. Yeah, that's fascinating that you were in TV writing, because that's one of the. It's one of the hard ones for me to, because I thought I was going to write for TV, and then when I started to realize what it takes and how you have to write in someone else's voice, and then this whole like, and I'm like, I don't want to write in anyone. I don't care about someone else's voice, and I don't care enough about writing and working on characters. Like people would, you would think, oh, it'd be the greatest thing to be in a TV room, writer's room on Seinfeld, but. At the same time, yeah, maybe for a couple weeks, but after that, it's you're trying to get your jokes on the air. You're trying to appease the show creator, and all of a sudden, it doesn't feel like creativity. It feels like tech support for siphoning the right thing out of your mind to get it into someone else's mind. The acid just kicked in, so feel free to call.
I mean, I think it depends on the show. It depends about your
Okay.
connection to the show because
Yeah.
if you're as a writer who does love crafting character, if you love the character, now you get to actually write about that character for years. Like you don't just write about the character for 90 minutes to 120 minutes, what have you, and then you're done. You never get to develop that character further. So if you're on a show that you love, right, it's like if you're watching your favorite TV show.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm watching Shrinking. I don't know what your favorite show is or what's on right now, but if you're watching something that you love, you don't want it to end. And I think it's the same if you're writing a character, there's always layers to uncover. I mean, but again, it depends on the show, right? I've been on shows where I can't wait to get out of there. And so, it's you have to like what you're writing ultimately.
Oh my God, that makes so much sense. I just wrote an essay about that regarding the novel, where it where when we write a novel, like I'm reading novels all the time because that's just where that's where I feel the most like storytelling buzz. And I feel like novels change me and I get so excited. Someone recommended The Count of Monte Cristo to me and I was just like, that is like, are you sure? Are you sure, man? Come on, that just sounds no. And the guy's like, just read the first 50 pages and shut up. And I did, and I loved it, and I read it to the end. And the book changed me. And it's so I feel like I was being that I was being what do you call it? Not enough knowledge of what TV writing is because I engage with my characters on a daily basis for like 4 years.
Right.
And I have my different relationships with them. I want to kill them because they want to go a certain direction, and then all of a sudden we make up, and it's just that's the whole idea of creativity. That's the juice.
Yeah, but you're right that it is. I mean, it's a very different medium, in terms of writing a book. It's just you and the characters living in your mind and the decisions that you all make together. But with TV, there are notes that you're going to get from a studio or a network. There are going to be other people in the room that have different ideas, that than you do. And so it's a very different, more collaborative type of process. And it's not for everyone. And again, it also really depends on the show. If you're in a room where you hate half the people you're writing with, that's going to be a very different
Oh, yeah.
experience than being in an intimate room where you're all kind of enhancing each other's ideas and there's more synergy. So it just really depends on the environment. I think that the best writers' rooms I've been in, any idea that I've had is just improved by the people around me and hopefully vice versa. So, those are great experiences, but you can also have the complete opposite.
When what's one of the writers' rooms that you were in where you got to really play with? Because I know some of the writer like you'll get to have a writers' room and there'll be like a couple writers attached to one character kind of for the is that how it works for some shows where it's just like oh you're taking a guy I used to know what did he write for? Big Love. He wrote for Big Love, and he was writing for the Bruce Dern character. So a lot of his work was actually working with Bruce Dern on what's going on, and I guess there was a lot of freedom there. But what was your experience in a great writer's room that you can say what TV show it was, and they will be happy to hear about it. And then we'll talk about the worst one so you can burn all your bridges.
All right. At this point, who cares? The industry is, who knows if it's going to be here tomorrow.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I have heard of rooms like that. It's few and far between. I would say most writers' rooms, and certainly the ones that I've been in, you don't have people assigned to certain characters. Everybody it's more that you're assigned a particular episode, and it might not even be the episode that you came up with. So Family Guy, for example, that's a show that at the beginning of every season, the writers will like...
You worked on Family Guy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I got my start there in the sense that I was there for 8 years in various capacities. And by the time I left, I wrote what became the 250th episode and then got staffed from there. But I was a production assistant, coordinator, Seth's second assistant, his first assistant. So I basically had two college degrees in the Seth MacFarlane universe and then got my first writing credit and went on to get staffed on other shows. But so that's an example of a show, massive writer's room. Their budget grows every season. So they had like 26 writers, I think, when I started there. But that's highly unusual. But everyone would go up to Seth's house. Everyone would come up with ideas for episodes at the beginning of the season. Everyone would pitch their ideas. Maybe one writer, three of their ideas were one of the episodes that season, but he or she, they were not the ones writing all of those episodes. Maybe they got to write one of their ideas, but then a different writer whose episode didn't get chosen is still going to get the chance to write an episode. They're just going to be given someone else's idea. And so usually the way that shows like that work is you'll have your ideas, the premises for the shows, and then it will get broken in the room, like the actual story beats and some sort of like rough outline. And then on the comedies, you'll have gag rooms, or sometimes you do it as a whole room. Where people will come up with tons of different jokes for all the different scenes you've laid out. And then that one person, depending upon the show, it could be 4 days, it could be 2 weeks, they'll go off and they'll write the episode and then they come back and then everyone punches it up together. So it just, that's an example of a format from a show like Family Guy. But I would say that's pretty similar to shows I've worked on, including dramas as well, where you're writing every single voice of every single character. Now, there's some people on the show that maybe have a kinship to one of the characters. Like there's one guy on Family Guy who just everyone thought of him as Stewie. His name's Gary Jannetty.
Yeah.
He like was Stewie, you know, for all intents and purposes. When he would pitch something, it was like always so dead on. Like you don't want to touch anything that he says if he's writing the voice of Stewie. So like there's sometimes people like that. But even like a Gary Jannetty episode, like he's still going to go and there's going to be other characters and he's writing all the characters. So having those people in the room are helpful because they can really add that authenticity when it's lacking. But we're still all writing different characters.
And that's such a fascinating show because the jokes and the layers of jokes are just off the hook. It's fast, it's punchy, poignant, and sometimes it has some really like great observations of like culture in general. It's just and also of love. There's a love story between Peter and I forgot what the name of the wife was.
Lois.
Yeah, there's like this Rhode Island love story happening that you want them to win. It is, we like them. We like the dynamic. And that's a writer's room of 26 people that I feel like this great Seth MacFarlane created that show. I don't feel like people understand how much brain power it takes to get that 22 minutes or whatever they need every week where it's just like, that's like, the top of the game type writing.
Yeah. And that's been on for so long at this point. So to be able to keep that all up at that level is definitely not an easy beat. But, to the point, what you were saying about studios coming in and networks coming in, and what are some shows that I didn't like working on, and all of
Yeah,
that.
tell me those, 'cause yes. The worst show you
So,
worked on. Let's
well, the
go.
worst show I worked on was my favorite show to write for. It never got made. Well, it did get made, but not the version that we worked on. So I wrote on Good Times, which was
Was
kind
that
of
the
the,
reboot?
yeah, the re
Okay.
the animated reboot, which we
Okay.
like to call Norman Lear's spiritual successor to his original.
Yeah. Oh,
So,
he's such an innovator. Everything he touched
yes.
was just
Oh my
fantastic.
God. The man was, yes, a total genius. So, and what he's done, just for the industry as a whole has been remarkable. But so, wrote on his spiritual successor, the animated reboot of Good Times. Carl Jones was at the helm. The whole thing was inspired by just Carl's own family growing up. And so there was so much of Carl's voice on the show. And this is all about, adapting your voice, what we were talking about, adapting your voice to whatever the show is. So in this case, we were really leaning into Norman's original version and also Carl's vision for what he wanted this spiritual successor to be. It was an unbelievable writer's room. I want to say there was like six of us. It was during COVID, so it was a Zoom room. But we had all like written, save for one great writer, the rest of us had written together before, so we all knew each other really well. We already had that vibe, which would have been hard, I think, coming in cold to a Zoom room. But we already had that energy. It was, we banged out the most interesting, funny, deep scripts that we were so proud of. And then there were creative differences between our showrunner and the vision that we had as a room with Sony Animation and Netflix. And they basically, like, threw out the scripts, fired everyone off the show, and a whole new writer's room came in, and that's what you see on TV. But I have to tell you, so like the process of doing it, the notes that we got really were not in keeping with the version that had been sold and this beautiful thing that we were all so proud of, and we all really stood by that version. Hopefully it gets to see the light of day at some point in the future through the mouths of different characters or something, because the scripts were just so touching and fun. But this was an example of like the worst room I had ever written in, just because of what transpired. And I can't even, I don't think, share with you some of the notes that we were given, because they were so offensive in terms of how some of the people were, were treated, and the characters, and just the not, there was a misalignment, I guess, of what the show was trying to say and what Netflix wanted to show, I think is probably the most diplomatic way to put it. At the time, they were really going for more of like a broad appeal. How could we put the most on the air that appeals to everyone, like every show for every person? And
Which
this
is
was
where
something.
creativity goes to die. If it's for
Exactly.
everybody, then who wants to watch it?
Exactly. And this was something that was like so specific from someone's POV, that the idea was to bring people into that world as opposed to how can we make this world palatable for every person?
Ugh,
Yeah. So,
gross.
yeah. So that's okay, the most diplomatic way I'll put it. And then, so not a great experience there, but also my favorite room I was ever a part of. Loved every single person in it, loved the scripts we churned out. And so you can have both happening at the same time. Yeah. So
Did
those are just
you
two examples.
watch a lot of the original Good Times episodes to do
Oh, yeah.
research?
Of course. Yeah.
I don't know, 'cause sometimes maybe they w don't even want you to watch the original. I wouldn't
There was,
know.
yeah, there was no mandate. It's not like, here's a packet of getting onboarded for this show and here's your homework assignments. But no, I think to really authentically write that show, we wanted to understand, I wanted to understand, what the original intent was and the characters, and to really do it all justice, I feel like you have to know, what it's coming from.
Now, the original Good Times, was that in the 1970s? Did Norman Lear do Odd Couple too? I can't remember.
Oh gosh, I will not pretend to be
Don't I won't be I won't pretend either. I'll just it's I was trying to remember what else he's done, because I know
He has
he did
had a
One Day
hand
at a
in
Time, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that's more recent though, but yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm literally like as we're chatting, I'm just Googling because I
You're on your device. See?
don't. Let's see. I don't think he was Odd Couple, but I don't want to take
Yeah,
away
I don't.
credit where credit
No,
is
you're
due.
right. I don't think he is. I don't think he is. When I got really depressed, sometimes when I get really depressed, I go back to those old 70s TV shows and it gets, and like The Odd Couple is just one of those ones where I can watch an episode of The Odd Couple and it just delights me to know that that is out there. And that's got to be something for the TV writers too, because you do have. You have been part of the Family Guy universe. And so being part of the Family Guy universe actually, I feel like all of this shifts the mythology of humanity, like all this storytelling. So even when I get, because I teach screenwriting actually, but you wouldn't think it the way I talk about it, but I do
No, I
love.
would have. I was a screenwriting major at USC. I would have loved to have you as a professor. So.
Oh, I love teaching screenwritings. I love write, I love screenwriting. I love writing screenplays. I adore it all, but thank you for the compliment. Now I'm totally thrown off that you complimented me because I don't know how to take compliments.
I could dish some more while you're thinking.
Well, we were talking about no, the mythology. So the mythology of humanity, like we're continuing to create it. Even Family Guy is creating the mythology of humanity at this current moment, and there's going to be a time just like way in the future where someone's going to be like, you know what? I watched those old Family Time animations that used to be like real animation that just feels so old, you know, but it makes me happy. And it's like, just like me when I watch the old Odd Couple TV show where it's just like, it makes me happy. And you're part of a universe that can make people happy. What's the 1970s? 50 years ago. So 50 years from now, let's say I'm doing math. 2076. There could be somebody going, "Oh my God, episode 250 of Family Guy." It just touches my soul on a certain level. So you are part of like the mythology of humanity as we continue forward. It's so much fun.
No, it's very cool. I don't know that anyone's going to say that about Peter Griffin
I don't know. I don't know, 'cause who would have
no,
thought?
I was going to say specifically in the episode that I wrote. It's Liam Neeson and Peter Griffin fighting each other. Like, I don't know whose soul that's going to end up touching, but.
Oh, I think I saw that one. I think I
Oh,
saw that one.
okay,
'Cause Liam Neeson's all about you're taking my wife, you're
Right.
taking my daughter. Where is my grandmother?
Exactly. So, I don't know about soul touching, but certainly the franchise as a whole. And, you know, when I was working for Seth, there were so many instances I got to see of kids from like the Make-A-Wish Foundation that. You know, their one wish was to meet him, to come see the office. Yeah, so like I could definitely attest to the fact that there are people out there where it really shaped their childhood. It really gave them hope and laughter. And so it is a really cool thing to be a part of. And I think that's what was so fun about getting to write this book is that this was my first time where even if it's one person that ends up being really affected by it, it was all me, right? It was all my voice, all my lived experience. And so I've had that experience before, but it was a part of a collective. And so this is the thing I get to leave behind, in addition to my daughter, right? That hopefully will go on to touch other people.
Did you hear that squeak? Was that me or are you?
I've been actually hearing the entire time in my headphones, like voices.
That might not
Let's
be your
not,
headphones.
I was going to say, let's not read into that too much, but I've been hearing all kinds of things. I don't know where it's coming from, if
Oh,
my
strange.
end or your end. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Are you on Bluetooth or are you on wire?
No, it's wire.
Oh, okay. I
But it
think
sounds like there's like
we're
a sports game on or something.
really?
Are you watching a game?
Oh, no. I let me places. Hey, all right. When we're back. We were just talking about mythology. We were talking about, oh, having your own name on a book. That's the beauty of writing and being an author is you alone are responsible, not only for the good, but for the bad of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something so huge about you that this is your first time standing out as an author, correct?
Right.
How does it feel?
It's great. It's nice to just have it out there. It's such a long process, as you know. And I thought it would be anxiety inducing to know that all these prints are out there and there's not a single word I can change. And I'm going to find all these things after the fact that I want to change about it. But really it's given me peace. Like I feel like I did everything I could to put myself on the page. Yeah. It's nonfiction. So that's, you know, a whole different ballgame in the sense that, you know, it's one thing to want to change something about a character, but like, this is how people reading it will remember my actual life. So
yeah.
It's, you know, it's, I thought it would give me more agita than it has. It's just been this wave of calm of like, okay, I put a lot of work into this and now it's out there and now I get to think about what that next thing's going to be.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, even with nonfiction, even with journalism, even with novel writing, we have to just do, it's like we get to the point where we did the best we can. We squeezed every piece of juice we could into those pages. Mm-hmm. And then when you've done that, then there is a sense of like, okay, I got to let this go because this isn't me. There's no more me I can put into it. There's the next thing. And of course, we have lovely editors and publishers that go, hey, wait a second, what if blank? And you're like, oh, those notes are usually always right. Like my editor on my first book, man, she had some like notes where I was just like, whoa, you know, she just throw a few questions at me and I'll be like, okay, I got to think about that for a couple of days, and I'd sleep on it. And I'd be like, no to that, yes to this, what do you think? You know, and the same way in screenwriting where you get the notes and you're like, yes, no, yes. The one script that I've had get to completion, we had notes of taking out a certain element, two certain elements, and the producer was like, no, we're not going to do that, and just getting really like angry about it. I'm like, oh, whoa, hold on. Let's just sit with those notes. Let me reread the script tonight and let me sleep on it. And we'll just see if the notes have validity. Now, the notes were about taming down language in this one scene. And I slept on it and I was like, you know, they're not that they're right because of toning down the language, but it's too strong for the character to say this. And I was really glad to get that note. And I said, go tell those people they're right about that. That it is a bad word and we shouldn't have bad words. But what that note wasn't about me going, let's see how we can take out this word. That note was me rethinking my character and going, wait, would that character actually be at this point and at this time in the script? And I was like, oh my God, no, we need to take it out because for the creative part of it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes even a bad note is a good note. And you just let the person who gave you the note that's from a stupid angle, but always let all the notes kind of sink in before pushing back and then go, okay. And you just, you know, stroke people's ego and go, that's a great note. Thank you. And they don't need to know that you like slept on it and reread the whole screenplay and thought through the moments of the character and where we are in the story, and you know, oh, that's a great note. Yes, take out that swear word. Oh, such a
great. And I think the whole thing's always like, what is the bump behind the bump? You know, the note itself might not really be speaking to something that you believe is worth changing, but something's bothering them, and maybe they're not able to really articulate what it is or why. But
yeah,
if you could figure that out, probably there's a change to be made. It just might not be the one they think needs to get changed.
And that's beautiful because that's it. It kind of made me think more about like real life where people say things that may be a little offensive or I'll take offense at. And then I sit down and think about it and go, oh, you know, wait, you know what? I think I also acted wrong too. That was a pushback of me to act wrong. I don't think it was healthy of them to express it that way. but I do need to check myself because I wasn't coming from a healthy spot as well, like in real life.
Sure.
I mean, this is how I pick up women at grocery stores, and they're just like, and they're
this
just kind of
explains a lot.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, "Can you stop following me? I'm just trying to get eggs." No, no, wait. I got more. I got more. going back to so going from storytelling to matchmaking, I want when you see when you talk to somebody when you're coaching them, do you also kind of think of a three act or four act structure of people's lives or of their romance? Do you sit there and think in your head, act one, they meet, there's the status quo, they both don't want to be lonely, they both want to find that person, and then the inciting incident is, do you think in those terms at all, or am I just being
It's
crazy?
funny you ask. So, not when it comes to an individual, in terms of their past, but my book, I don't know if you're saying this because you know this already, but
No,
my
I don't.
book, so I actually, if you look at the table of contents of my book, I
Yeah.
broke it into a three act structure. I
Yeah.
literally say act one, and I have chapters that are called things that are film terminology. Like, I think I
Yeah.
have a chapter called The Inciting Incident. Like, I literally
Okay.
have all the meet cute, right? Like, all the different film
Yes.
terms are the chapter titles. And then I did break my book, which covers three clients' journeys to find love. I break those journeys down into a three act structure. And so I do marry my loves, you know, finding
Yeah.
people love and my background as a screenwriter, I did blend that together for this book. And I do generally think about characters the way I would think about my clients, right? When I'm interviewing somebody, I want to know, I need to know, you know, how experience what experiences shape them to be who they are today in terms of the lens through which they see dating through. I need to know what their present is like if I'm coaching somebody to know what advice to give them to help enhance their journey. And I need to have a vision for their future of what type of person I see them with. And so to that end, I do kind of look at someone in a three act structure format. But yeah, it is a really good question just because I don't know if you're expecting that answer, but I literally did break my
Well,
book
yeah,
down that
right,
way.
right. We type the blah, blah, blah. Como se dice in English, my first language. We emailed back and forth because I didn't receive your book, and so you sent me a PDF copy. So I didn't get I just got a chance to kind of I barely had a chance to look at the title page.
Yeah, I have to talk to Avid Reader about this, by the way, because they told me they sent you a copy of Love.
You know what? And they may have, and I live in a big apartment building, and someone else may have picked it up, and they have found love by reading your book, and it turned out to be the best case scenario because they're gonna procreate a kid that's going to take us to salvation 30 years from now.
And you
So.
know what? If that's you listening, if you are the person that took Tony's copy of the book and it is changing your life, comment on this podcast.
Comment and call her. What's your phone number? Because it sounds like your dad just gives it out. Why don't we just give it out to everybody?
Yeah, so what do they do in movies? 555.
Yeah. 666. I always like to
Yeah.
do the 666 area code. It's I'm in hell. I'm in hell. That is fascinating, though, that we both that I maybe I saw that, maybe I didn't. I don't know. I can't remember. But what a beautiful because what and here's where I come at it as I think of like my life and my problems. I always think I'm going through my own three act structure on very different things. So if I'm coming to the end of a chapter of a problem or you know or a relationship issue or just something where I'm shifting in my life. I feel like I'm always having just the human condition is we're having inciting incidents all the time. We're having a break into two where we've realized we need to go on the journey. And then when we learn how to slay the dragon, like all of that really feeds into how we can progress in life. And that's, I think, the reason why the three act structure exists because we get to fake play as audience members with this hero's journey. Yet we are the hero's journey if we can also think the same way and we can put ourselves in scary places because we went on the journey and we can slay the dragon. the amphetamine just kicked in. Go ahead. Your thoughts?
No, I agree. I thought that was very well said.
Oh, thank you. Well, shucks. So after writing, you wrote nonfiction before though? I mean, I'm not on TV or as TV. Like, have you like really sat down and written essays and other things before hitting the book, or did you just go straight for the book?
I went straight for the book. I mean,
I think you've slayed many dragons. I think you've had a ton of act threes in your life to get here. Go ahead.
Yeah. See, I'm older than you think. of course there's little pieces here and there, thoughts about various subjects and what have you, but none that have been, published certainly. And so, this was really my first foray into nonfiction. It was not intended to be so much of myself in the book. It was never pitched as a memoir style or narrative nonfiction book. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to, when I took it out originally with my agent, I had put together a very comprehensive book proposal that was very straightforward, very prescriptive. You know, people in Hollywood struggle with their dating lives, you know, same as you. Chapter one, here's how I taught them how to up their flirt game or improve their confidence, right? So it was very straightforward. And then across the board, I just got feedback from various publishers. We love your voice, but no one really knows who you are. It's not really, for something to sell in this genre, they're going to buy a book from Tinks or another influencer, you know, that already has millions of followers. I'm not sure that if someone's buying 3 self-help books a year, if that they're going to buy it from someone they don't know, but we love your voice but it's a pass, right? But Avid Reader, who, you know, where I ended up getting it published under, they, you know, thank you so much to them. Like, they were able to, Jofi Ferrari Adler and Juliana Halbner over there, they read my proposal, same exact thing. They were like, we love your voice. No one knows who you are. I thought that was going to be the end of it, but it was like, ... Would you consider crafting this to be more narrative nonfiction or memoir style? Which is funny because in my mind, my instant reaction was, well, if the whole thing is no one knows who I am, why would they be interested in my life story, right?
Oh, wow.
But yeah. When it comes to memoir style writing, I think if you are talking about a very niche subject or area, that can sometimes pull people in. And so the fact that I set up people in Hollywood, my husband's someone I set up 5 times before he and I got married. And so just my story was different, you know, and it was different enough that they felt like it was something worth taking a chance on. And so suddenly I found myself writing myself into the book, so that it would actually be more approachable to people. And here we are.
Okay. Now the big question is, you set your husband up 5 times before you got married. So
it was me.
And that was the winner.
No, I didn't. Sometimes people are like, well, who asked who out? And so getting ahead of that one.
Oh, who asked you out?
No. I'm saying sometimes the follow-up is who asked who out? Like, you said.
Oh, well, that's a good, that's a great question. I didn't even think of it.
What was your question?
So you asked him out?
I did.
Okay. No, my question was, were you just setting him up with like ugly losers?
So you could
get to him.
He always jokes with people. He's like, she was sabotaging me. Like, he says it completely in jest, because honestly, the women I introduced him to were phenomenal.
Yeah.
These women are such catches, such incredible people. And he would have been so lucky to end up with any of these women. You know, I really thought highly of them. And I thought highly of him, you know, so it felt like strong introductions, but you know, you live, you learn. You can't always predict what someone's going to be interested in. And it was definitely, like, none of the matches went more than, like, 2 dates.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I don't think a reflection on either party. It's just the right person wasn't put in front of
it. It's a fun idea. Now, at what point do you go, oh, wait, I think I have feelings for this guy. Were you like setting him up on date four and going, and was your head kind of going, okay, trying to push it down? Like there's that's usually like this is the rejection to the journey, right? This is the debate part. Were you trying to push down feelings because you worked with him in a business type situation?
Yes and no. I mean, the way that my business operates, so when I met him, which was a year and a half before he and I even went on our first date, when he and I met, my business partner was with me. We meet all of our clients together and we meet someone for like 45 minutes to an hour. Now we don't even do it in person anymore. We just meet people on Zoom. And so, but at the time we met him in person, and then you don't see them again. Right, you're setting them up and you learn more about them from the people you match them with and the feedback you get than you do in that initial meeting. So it's not like I met him for an hour and was like, oh my gosh, I thought he was really cute. I might have lingered a little bit to talk to him longer in the parking lot, but there was nothing going on between us. And I really was just eager to set him up with other women. I also at the time, and this is all in the book, but I had been in a relationship for about 3 years. And so I was not thinking like, oh, I just met my husband. That being said, I was in, wasn't the healthiest of relationships. And I think when I was setting Dave up over the year and a half with the five different people, he was so charming and cheeky in his feedback. And he's not a writer, but he honestly should be just because he's very funny on the page. He's a great storyteller. And so I was learning a lot about him through writing. And at one point, he was like a little bit flirtatious, like trying to explain why he wasn't hitting it off with the people I had introduced him to. I think he was feeling self-conscious, like, I hope she doesn't think I'm too picky. But in trying to describe what he was looking for, he said something like, I'm just looking for someone like you, like somebody cute. Not that, you're not that cute because I'm not that picky. Like he was like really rambly, but also it was an email and he didn't have to send it. So, he was, I think
I
right around
think I could be
that.
friends with him. Like the way you're talking about him, it's just like I want to be best friends with him. Go ahead, keep
Yeah,
going.
he's a fun hang. He went to, I'll mention this, I don't know when the episode's coming out, but it's Coachella time right now. And he went to Coachella 11 times, if that tells you anything about him. So
Oh,
he's
we might not be friends then. Okay, go
he does
ahead.
go to fish shows. It's not a,
No, it's wow. This this
it's taking a
matchmaking
turn.
with this matchmaking with you and your husband is just
Taking a turn, taking a turn. Do you like the Mets? Do you like musical theater?
like the Mets. I do like the Mets. I'm from San
Okay.
Francisco. I'm a Giants fan, but when the Mets play, I'm kind of rooting for them, even though Juan Soto's on the team now, and I really don't like Juan Soto, so
Oh, boo. Well, so okay, the two of you could connect over baseball to some degree. Just you'll avoid the Juan Soto talk. So, yeah, so he's somebody who, as he was getting like a little flirty, I was also really just not in this great relationship. And so I passed him off to my business partner. I'm very tunnel vision in a relationship. And even the fact that he called me cute in an email to me was enough of a blurred line that I was like, Lauren, you're going to be setting him up from now on. So she started matching him.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I keep that we both, she and I, keep things very, very professional.
Yeah, that you're so millennial. It's so cute 'cause like Gen X would be like, hey, let's go smoke some cigarettes and have 40s in the parking
Right,
lot.
I know. So yeah, I would say I need to work on that, but it worked out in my favor. So I passed him off. He even wrote a cheeky email after being like, did you pass me off?
Oh, yeah. I love his
Yeah. And I was like,
approach.
yeah, I was like, no, not at all. I just, Lauren knows the next woman you're meeting better than I do. So she's going to take point on your next match.
I
So she
love your
started,
approach too. Look at
right?
that. Look at, oh my God, this is just like a ball tossing back and forth of just like perfect answers. Okay.
Right. But then after that incident or whatever you want to call it took place, I became single, nothing to do with that, but like
gosh,
maybe
the
6 months
boyfriend was a
later.
prick. Your boyfriend was a prick. I know you've said, oh, it's been unhealthy, but I also know that you're very kind. And from this, long relationship that we've had over the last 54 minutes. And so you weigh your words carefully, but you know what? That guy, no, very unhealthy. A therapist could have told you that within the
The
first two or three
dynamic.
dates.
Listen, good guy. He's a good guy, and I'm sure, is
God,
making
you
someone very happy now. But our
what's his
dynamic
what's his
together,
name? What's his name? I'm kidding.
I don't mention it in the book for a reason. I
No,
don't. But
it's good you don't mention people's
people are
names.
too litigious these days. But no, honestly, like, wish him nothing but the best. He's a good guy. Our dynamic was unhealthy, and so.
Ah, look at you taking responsibility. You see, now that is actually great. And that's what we all should be doing when we, because I have this problem too. Sorry I interrupted you, but like the resentments of my old relationships, I realize are like my problem. And where I go, oh, wait a second, what was my problem in that relationship? Because I was married for a long time too, and went through like a really freaky divorce. Freaky is such a weird word to say, but I realized what my problem was too. It's not all her to blame, even though it went south in a very strange way. And but
I'm
anyway, I
so
won't.
curious about this. And have you already shared with your listeners what this freakiness is? Because if you haven't, I would love to hear.
She liked it in the butt. No, but maybe a little bit, but that's, yeah, I could tell you after we're taping, because we're getting
I
towards
love
the
that you
end.
told me before this. You were like, don't curse, but I'm going to talk about butts.
Yeah, oh no, yeah, this is radio. See, there's certain things we can allude to, like we could, I should have said being offensive is okay. Maybe that would have been
Yeah,
a
I've
better
been
way.
holding back to
Oh
me.
my God. Oh
Like,
my God. This could have been totally just, this could have
great. Let's
been.
start over. I want to start.
Okay. Going back to one. Her book is called Your
Your last
Last.
first butts.
Now you're trying to get it all in the last 2 minutes of the show. Okay,
First butt butts.
we get to talk about butt sex. What else can I put? Nipple rings, nipple
Wait,
rings.
So we're totally getting off topic because I still really need to know what the freakiness was.
Right, I'll tell you after taping because I've
Fair.
talked about
Yeah.
it on the show.
Oh, okay.
Yes, the title of the book is Your Last First Date: Secrets from a Hollywood Matchmaker. Her name is JD Samuels Cuba. JD, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you again for the invitation and excited to sidebar with you shortly.
JD Samuels Cuba on Drinks with Tony. Check out her new book, Your Last First Date: Secrets from a Hollywood Matchmaker. Also, you can go to her website, ljmatching.com, and she's also got Instagram, Match Made in Hollywood. That's with the at sign. All right, thanks for listening, and come out to my free library workshop on May 6th at the Los Feliz Library Branch Library. Go to tonyduchesne.com for all the information on that. I will see you next week.